Listen to the teaching. May I become Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Correct your motivation. So this peaceful teaching, which is the source of happiness and joy, this teaching of the Buddha, which is a nectar to the ears of anyone who hears it. Therefore, come and listen to this teaching. And it dispels or cures the disease of all the diseases of negative emotions. And the teaching to this, all the gods, nagas, and yakshas and so forth, in everyone's language, I'll give this teaching. Pay homage to the Buddha, the Gautama, who's taught, out of, moved by his This is the prayer to Buddha Manjushri. So with all of your kindness and love, let your wisdom shining light clear the darkness of my ignorance once and for all. Grant me, I pray, the intelligence, the brilliance to understand the scriptures, words of the Buddha, and works of masters. And so today we are going to engage in the text which deals with the special insight section of penetrative insight section of Lamrim Chemo, commenting on the difficult points and with raising lots of questions and answering them and so forth. So the Buddha has taught the teaching of selflessness or emptiness, which was not known in the world at that time. And so, the Buddha related the teaching with regard to the basis, and then the path, such as the 37 factors of enlightenment, and using them as the object, the subject, he went on to say that they are empty, and in the end, say at the end of the each of the going over what are known as the 108 points or objects, then he said all of these are in name. And in the 25,000 verses of this Pajaparamita, Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, it goes through this. And this 8,000 verses of Pajaparamita also, if you just read it, you may not understand right away. But if you are able to combine or study it along with the Abhisamaya Alamkara, ornament for the clear realization, you'll understand what is being taught with regard to the progress along the path. And these scriptures are called perfection of wisdom, not perfection of faith or concentration, but perfection of wisdom. And so even by name, the teaching of the Buddha is a teaching which should be progress, in which one should progress along the paths and the stages of the path by understanding the emptiness, how things are, and therefore one should base oneself on reason and not merely resort to scripture. And therefore wisdom is important in the beginning, in the middle, and at the end. And therefore, since the teaching of the Buddha should be understood within the framework of the Four Noble Truths, with regards to the cessation, true cessation, it has its four characteristics, such as cessation, peace, excellence, and deliverance. And so in order to understand this true cessation, it is important to understand dependent origination as well. So all the different philosophical traditions of the Buddha are based on or teach the Four Noble Truths. So if you understand the Four Noble Truths and be able to understand the emptiness thoroughly, then you'll be able to explain the Four Noble Truths more precisely and thoroughly. And therefore, in the teaching of the Buddha, the teaching of emptiness is the one which it used to introduce the teaching of the Buddha. And particularly in the Nalanda tradition, this reality of dependent origination is very important to understand. And as I have already quoted the 400 verses of Aryadeva, for one, for those who have no faith in the Buddha Dharma, they should be introduced to the Dharma and to be, feel and make inspired, I mean inspired by teaching the dependent origination. And therefore, it's really is something, this dependent origination, teaching on the dependent origination is really something which inspires you and you gain aspiration to the teaching of the Buddha or your interest grows. And when you go further, what is the purpose of the teaching of emptiness? Is it merely to boast for the scholars to boast their brightness? If you look at our daily life, saying that things are devoid of any intrinsic existence, having explained it, having said that things are without any essence, the more conviction you gain in it, the appearance of the things, whatever appears to you regarding that, so being enshrouded in the darkness of ignorance, as it is said in the Three Principles Path, whatever appears to you or experiences happen to you, they appear as if they have some objective independent existence. So it's a matter of whether someone has actually introduced this to you or not. When you are sitting somewhere, you feel that I have. I mean, when I look at you, and I have this attitude that you, all of you individually, are there. And when you look at me, I am a Shakya Bhikshu, or Bhikshu in the tradition of Shakyamuni Buddha. And you gave me the title Gyawa Thungi Dakpo, or the Lord, the Victorious One. And you, I appear to you, and you appear to me, as if there is some person out there, a solid entity. And if you really, if you search for that person, then that appears to you. I mean, I cannot find that person. And when you look at me, you see my body. You see the body of a Buddhist monk. And when I talk, you hear my speech, or my voice, and from the, my expressions of speech and body, you could, to a certain extent, know what kind of thought processes are going on in my mind. But this body, speech, and mind are the body, speech, and mind of Dalai Lama. But when you actually look for the Dalai Lama, you cannot find him. So everything in the samsara and nirvana are designated by the mind. But that designating mind itself, if you look for its identity, you cannot find it. The seventh Dalai Lama says this. And in Jonang tradition also, there is a saying, the bare appearance of the illusion-like things, or the bare illusion here, bareness here refers to as if there is some kind of a solid entity. And if you relate that to the perception which conceives it, then this mind or awareness does not have any basis, but there is a mere experience that this clear perception is there, or the awareness. And since nothing can be pointed to as being this or that, it says you go or dissipate into the inexpressible. And so, whether internal or external, everything, there's nothing which is which exists solidly. And therefore, if something to be objectified is left, even a slight bit of thing is left to be objectified, what happens is you grasp onto some kind of a true existence, and because of it, wrong kind of a mentation happens. And then the rest of the negative emotions. So on the other hand, there are those mental states or experiences such as love and compassion which arise on the basis of not inappropriate thinking, but appropriate thinking. And therefore, with regard to emptiness, what it does is it uproots what is the cause that caused ruins to us. Whereas the virtuous states of mind, to them, the understanding of emptiness actually serves as a support. And therefore, by thinking about bodhicitta, thinking about suffering, by thinking about suffering of sentient beings, you cultivate or the wish to become a Buddha for their benefit. And so this bodhicitta, what it goes against is self-cherishing attitude, extreme self-centeredness. So we do not want suffering, but want happiness. So we are somehow related to everyone who has that feeling of not wanting suffering, but wanting happiness. And therefore, in the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha made the selflessness as the basis of his teaching, and then in the second turning of the wheel of the Dharma, he elaborated on it. And then we have, on the basis of these teachings of Prajaparamita, we have Nagarjuna's writings. It's not just it should be the case that that there are these texts written by Nagarjuna, which are amongst the Tengyur collection, but if you really read those writings, the works, you will see how the explanation of emptiness that is given in those writings can actually make the grasping a true existence dumbfounded. And then following Nagarjuna, we have Buddhapalita, Chandrakirti, and Shantideva, and so forth, writing their commentaries on the Mula Madhyamaka Karika and so forth. And then we have Master or Abbot Chandrakshita and Kamalashila, his disciple, coming to India, coming to Tibet from India, writing their works on Madhyamaka. And so in this way, we have the teachings on the emptiness passed on by through Master Nagarjuna and so forth have come down to us, passing from one master to the next. And so Master Nagarjuna, as prophesied by the Buddha, was able to comment on the Prajaparamita, I mean, the teaching of emptiness thoroughly. And the Chinese brothers and sisters, and Vietnamese and Korean Dharma brothers, and Japanese also, we all recite the Heart Sutra, in which it says that all the Buddhas of the three times became enlightened, perfectly enlightened, by relying on the perfection of wisdom, and then became Buddhas, and became Buddhas who have attained the four Buddha bodies. And then there are those who are becoming Buddhas presently, and there will be those who will become Buddhas in the future as well. And therefore, we need to aspire to become a fully enlightened being like the Shakyamuni Buddha himself. And so we are all following this tradition, which aspires to full enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. And therefore, the wisdom, perfection of wisdom. And so wisdom here refers to that understanding the things fully, or the sublime understanding, which helps to reach the nirvana and enlightenment. And so that enlightenment is a state whereby you remain without coming out of that meditative state forever on that emptiness, which is also the elimination of all defilements from the mind stream. And so in the beginning of the Heart Sutra, with regard to emptiness, there is the fourfold emptiness, which is referred by form is emptiness, and through to emptiness, and form too is not other than emptiness. And in the 25,000 verses of Panchaparamita, I'm not able to give all the wordings correctly, but what it says is that emptiness is not made empty by form is not made empty by emptiness, but form itself is emptiness, is empty. And therefore, the form or physical things are the basis on which you establish emptiness. So what this means is, the form is not made empty by emptiness means is that since form itself is empty of any intrinsic existence, therefore, it is empty by nature. And so form is empty. And emptiness is form. Regarding this, what arises through condition has no arising. And what is dependent on conditions does not have any essential existence. And therefore, they're empty of the way they appear to us. And therefore, what depends on conditions is empty, and one who understands this emptiness is heedful. And so this shows the purpose of emptiness. And therefore, form is empty because of being dependently originated, because it's empty of inherent or essential existence. Therefore, it is empty of inherent existence. And therefore, it is dependent on. It's feasible to say that it's dependent on conditions. Since form is dependent on conditions, although it appears to have some essential existence, it does not exist that way. and therefore emptiness is form. And therefore the basis, the conventional things in which are the myriad of things, and using these, then you try to understand how we hold on to self-cherishing attitude, and we need to think about cultivating cherishing others to counter this, and to as an antidote to the self-cherishing attitude. And so you have to here also differentiate between the conventional self and the intrinsically existing self, which is imputed or misconceived. And therefore, apply this antidote of cherishing one's others over oneself. So it is also helped by, backed by this grasping at true existence. And therefore, it's very nice to understand that we should counter the self-cherishing attitude as well as the grasping at true existence. And even scientists say that there's disparity between appearance and reality. For thousands of years, we have been saying that the things do not have any objective existence from out there, but this is what even scientists say today. And with regard to impermanence, subtle impermanence, of course we use our language to describe things like, oh, the tree that was there last year, this tree which was there last year and so forth, but which shows that there is a grasping at some permanence. Even the birds and can know this. And so they also know that they would be able to feed their babies when there are more insects and so forth during certain seasons, and therefore they give birth to their children because they can feed it. It may have to do with some climate as well, perhaps. And so every change that is happening in a year, it happens in a month, and every month in a week, and week in a day, and day in an hour, and hour in minutes, and minutes in seconds, and then smaller fractions of seconds. And so if you talk about the particles, if you go down to the subtlest particle, it's momentarily changing. So I have also seen it through microscopes. When you go into the subtler particles, it's always like light, fluctuating all the time, not static. And therefore, everything is impermanent like that. And so, what I was trying to say is, regarding the teaching of the Buddha, which is based on the two truths, and then the four truths, and the two truths, on the basis of which we have the method and wisdom for accomplishing the fruits of the two Buddha bodies. And so, all of us should, when you recite the Heart Sutra, you should reflect on these meanings, not as if you are reciting something in someone else's, in a different, strange language. So it will, when you think along these meanings while reciting Heart Sutra, then it will leave a very special imprint on your mind for emptiness. And now let's go through the teaching of the profound emptiness. So it's not easy to understand, but you cannot just neglect or leave it aside, saying it's very difficult, but we should persevere, be diligent, just as Master Tsongkhapa himself had done. He had not come to gain insight into emptiness right away without putting effort. If you look at his own writings, which were written before he had completed his analysis or investigation into the view, and And after completing his analysis into the view that were written later in the later part of his year and his life, so if you see that Jerembuche was Manjushri, a real in person, then and you will feel that that he had uneasy to say that he has not realized emptiness in the earlier part of his life. And therefore, it's better to think of him as a human being who has gone through the process of learning, studying, and having studied, reflected on the meaning, and then meditated, and then gained conviction thoroughly through this process of learning, reflection, and meditation. So we are also same human beings. And then with regard to Nagarjuna, Master Nagarjuna also, did I say this before? We usually imagine depict him as having some the hooves of hoods of snake hoods. Maybe he was not like that. We also depict him with the crown protrusion. That may be true. And so I saw some painting where that crown protrusion was painted red somewhere. So that is not perhaps not suitable. So there was during the 13th Dalai Lama's, there was someone, a bodyguard named Thubten Nyingchi. So he had a bald crown at the crown of his head. It's bald. It was bald. So with regard to the Buddha himself, going back to the Buddha, he was born as in the royal family of a king. And he may not be a big king ruling over a huge land or kingdom, but maybe as a chieftain or a ruler of a small principality. So he was born, the Buddha was born in such a royal family. And the Buddha himself, who enacted the deeds of enlightenment, was born on this earth as a human being. And so if we look at the Buddha as a human being, then it's not good for us also to draw inspiration. So we cannot say that those masters like Master Nagarjuna and so forth were different, and they are exceptions. It's not right to do that. You should think that we are same human beings. Otherwise, the teaching on the Buddha nature makes no sense, which shows that we have the potential for the attaining the four Buddha bodies, and therefore we have to gather all our energy to apply ourselves in the practice. And so the teachings of the emptiness is not to terrify us, but to inspire us for the for Buddhahood. Because we are at this moment more or less distracted by the pleasures of this life. And therefore, in order to lead us to enlightenment, the teaching saying there's nothing essentially exists are taught. So yesterday we left at the end of a comment or where it mentions Changya Rebbe Dorje's book on the tenet systems. And so with regard to the what is mentioned in Madhyamaka Avatara, it says in a convention or in the world, it is true. And so the in that verse, the two words, yangtak or correct or perfect, although there are one same word, but they have different meanings. And so according to the Mongolian master, Chögyam Awangpel, then what is said in his writings seems to be tenable, very tenable. So regarding the first, the reason is given as the in the perception of the Arya beings, and also the according to the Madhyamaka system, so which mean the same thing. And according to the great commentary on the Madhyamaka Avatara, by refers to the Jetsongkhapa's illumination of the thought. So from the perception, from the perspective of following the views or how the noble beings, the Arya beings see, according to this system of philosophy, the Prasangika system, the following the critically analyzing mind, in relation to that, all conventional phenomena are said to be erroneous. And the opposite of which is said to be which is said to be the correct and it means it refers to the intrinsic existence. There's no other way than this. So in the perspective of the the worldly conventional perspective, so here it refers to the correctness or incorrectness of the perceptions. And then it goes on to comment on a certain passage from Lakdong, the special penetrative insight, which is on page 181, where it says all sensory consciousnesses are alike in being mistaken with regard to what appears to them. However, sensory consciousness such as those to which a reflection appears are incorrect conventional consciousness. Other unimpaired sensory consciousness are correct conventional consciousness. This is based on whether there is an object compatible with what appears to the worldly perspective and that of sensory perspective of the that sensory consciousness. So regarding this, the text says that whether there is the phrase which says whether there is an object compatible with the with what appears to the worldly perspective of that sensory consciousness, regarding that phrase, We should understand this to mean that the form form exists, whereas the reflection of the form is does not exist as a form or the body. So if the form were to be the object or the object which is compatible with how it appears to the consciousness which apprehends it, then it should exist the way it appears. And the, by that you would also have to say that the reflection of an face in the mirror also does exist the way it appears. And therefore, there are lots of critical analysis that we should do, such as checking whether that appearance of the reflection in the mirror exists, and the apprehension of the. The apprehension of the form to be existent just as it appears could be clinging to true existence or not. And so with regard to the term correct conventional phenomena or correct convention, the correctness here and then the correct correct from the perspective of the worldly convention and the correctness in that phrase, the correct convention in that phrase, I mean, both of these correct, the word correct, do not mean the same thing. I mean, if they are not the same thing, then in the commentary on. And so, with regards to the conventional the three criteria of the conventional existence, I have not seen this mentioned anywhere else in other scholars' writings, but only in Jerembuche's writing here, where he says that it should be something which is renounced to the conventional cognition, and that it is not undermined by any other conventional cognition and valid cognition, and then it should also not be undermined by the reasoning mind analyzing reality. And in the auto commentary of the Madhyamaka Avatara, it says, it is true from the from the point of view of the world, but not from the point in relation to the Arya beings. So the phrase being true in relation to the world and not being true in relation to the Arya beings. The opposite of what it says is the true or the true existence. These two do not mean the same. I mean, the truth here, although the term truth is used in both cases, it is they do not mean the same.
Because when the phrase being true from the worldly perspective refers, I mean, the truth here refers to grasping at true existence and grasping at some self-characterized or self-defined establishment which do not exist at all, and therefore so all everything that, such as the body and the aggregates and so forth, without being satisfied with how they are established in convention, if you try to look for some essence or identity in them, there you can find nothing. This is the comment made by His Holiness. So the difference between the Pasangikas and the Savatantrika Madhyamakas is drawn here with regard to whether they accept things, even in convention, things to be correctly convention or incorrect conventions. So according to the Savatantrika Madhyamakas, they do make these two divisions within the conventional existence. So in order to avert any qualm with regards to the system of the Prasangikas, text mentions that they the text shows that there is no correct conventional existence. So because of this, I wonder if this phrase, it is not so in relation to the Arya's insight, in relation to the Arya. So without being content with the mere appearance on the basis of which a person is designated, the other philosophical schools like Chittamatras and assert that there is a person, essentially existing person, and they point to the Alaya Vijana as being the identity, the final identity of that person. And so if you posit such a person, then such an assertion is undermined or invalidated by the wisdom which critically analyzes the reality of a person. So between the Madhyamakas and between the Madhyamakas and the epistemologists, the logicians, there is some difference between whether they assert that a conceptual mind which sees something is mistaken with the appearing object of it or not. And then also whether they are mistaken with regards to the apprehended object or not, there is some difference. So 180 on page 183 in the translation of the Lakdong Chemo, there is this quotation from the commentary by Chandrakirti on the 400 verses, attachment and so forth superimpose features such as attractiveness and unattractiveness only upon the intrinsic nature of things that ignorance has superimposed. And so regarding this, I mean, regarding this whole phrase, therefore they do not work apart from ignorance. They depend upon ignorance. This is because ignorance is the main affliction. So the author of this commentary on the difficult points of Lakdong says, quotes this, and then its meaning, he says, is this. Other afflictive emotions such as attachment and anger so Master Nagarjuna also so with regard to how the attachment and anger arise in us, it's because of this inappropriate thinking which serves as the cause of attachment and anger. So with regard to the commentary of explanation of these lines, the afflictive emotions such as the other afflictive emotions such as desire and attachment or attachment and anger also arise because of this ignorance, which is superimposes some true existence. Ignorance holding on to true existence and superimposes that entity, which means an entity referring to the feature of having some intrinsic existence in things. And the ignorance, according to the 400 verses, is said to permeate all negative emotions. So in the commentary to this, it is mentioned that the negative emotions like attachment and anger depend on, and also they are not separate from it. There are two things mentioned. So those who assert that things have some objective existence, there is their way of identifying what attachment and anger are, and then there are those who do not assert any objective existence, and which is subtler than recognition of subtler attachment and anger. And this later one is actually maybe considered as a correct perception by the former ones. And so there may be some negative emotions which arise from the true grasping a true existence, but they are not concomitant with them. And so the ignorance which grasps as true existence of in things grasps of its own accord, grasps at such a way of existence of its own accord, whereas the negative emotions grasp at that not of its own accord, but because of being influenced by that ignorance. Perhaps we could make such a distinction. So this is very important. So as long as you say that, you assert that all the negative emotions such as attachment and anger and so forth are concomitant with the grasping at true existence, then you would have to say that they too are the mind grasping at true existence. And so the consequence is that there would also be the ignorance grasping at true existence. And so this very subtle, unique, the subtle negative emotions which are uniquely identified by the Prasangikas as being negative emotions are not necessarily the grasping, the ignorance grasping at true existence. So there are lots of qualms and raised in regarding this passage from the commentary on the 400 verses. So these are the qualms and the doubts that are raised here. The text says that they are mentioned partially in the commentary of the commentary on Madhyamaka Avatara by Trijit Baldin, the Mongolian master. And so those negative emotions like attachment and anger, which are concomitant with the ignorance grasping at true existence, are said to be concomitant with it and grasp at the true existence of the things which they see as attractive or unattractive because of the influence of the ignorance. And so because of what accompanies it, the grasping at true existence, the ignorance. And so the text, the author says that this, attachment and so forth, grasp at true existence, though they do so, but it's because of being concomitant with the grasping, the confusion grasping at true existence, and therefore which grasp at that true existence on its own of its own accord. So if you hold on to this kind of position, perhaps it's easier to hold one's position.
Or it says called first these negative emotions we could say that they arise in dependence on or they are induced by this the grasping ignorance grasping of true existence. And therefore, on the based on this kind of intrinsic existence, which is superimposed or which is reified by this grasping at true existence, and, the incorrect apprehension, all the incorrect apprehensions of cognitions could be said to be concomitant with the grasping at true existence ignorance. So if that is the case, then so with regard to compassion, there is the compassion is not influenced by the grasping at true existence as such, not induced by it. So the text, the author goes on to say that so with regard to the state of mind such as faith, and there is this feeling of gladness when you have faith or the admiration, faith of admiration, and when that in that experience, and the fact that there is the apprehension of the thing called to have some to be established from its own side with regard to the object, that is the grasping, the ignorance grasping at self or the true existence, and it's not the faith as such. And faith is necessarily a virtuous state of mind, and therefore it, there is no faith which is concomitant with the grasping at true existence. And there, and similarly, one could use the same law. One could apply the same rationale for to non-attachment and non-hatred and so forth. And it is said, according in this system, in the system of the Buddha Palita, Master Buddha Palita and Chandrakirti, it is said that to establish the conventionality of things is very difficult. And so, this is this could be understood easily if you look at how in the book on philosophical systems by Sherebrinchen, Taksang Lotsawa maybe Sherebrinchen, how he uses the called reasons to prove that Jerome Buche was actually denigrating the conventional truth, and also in the section under the called
too broadly, I mean, refutation of the identification of refutation of the object of the object to be negated, in the, I mean, which is too broad. In under that section, there is also this outline where it says that refutation of all the four points of the dilemma are not legitimate critique of conventional phenomena. Which is on page 189. So from there also, then we could easily understand. And therefore, there's no need to go over it for clarification, it says. And then in on page 189, I mean, under that heading, there is this phrase in the reply to where it says, then we also refute such non-things. So regarding that also, there's a comment. So it was it is more convenient if we could apply this to mean that as a refutation of the non-things to be established from its own from their own side. And then on page 109, there is a quotation in this part where it's the quorum saying Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise says, if there were the slightest trace which is non-empty, then a trace of emptiness would exist as well. As there is no trace that is non-empty, how could there be a trace of emptiness? So in the Prasannapada commentary, that it says here, what it says is that we cannot say that the basis of emptiness, that is an entity, and has any intrinsic existence. So to say so is, I mean, to say that it has any intrinsic existence is not feasible. And so in the Prasannapada, it goes through the how it adds the qualifications as well. So the commentary here says that if, regarding emptiness, it has the slightest existence or is established essentially from its own side, then its basis also would not have the slightest trace of being non-empty. But here, emptiness and selflessness are the general universal characteristics of all phenomena. So asserting this, therefore, there's no slightest thing which does not which is not devoid of the self. And therefore, how can emptiness also be, I mean, is an existent, I mean, how can emptiness exist as an essential existence? It cannot. So this is what is said in the great commentary. And so the term non-entity in the first line refers to the basis, which is not not empty of inherent existence, and then the non-empty in the third line, which and there is no trace that not the slightest thing that is non-empty. That phrase in the third line should be used to mean that there is nothing which is not empty of any intrinsic existence, no phenomena which is not empty. There's no phenomena whatsoever which is not empty of any intrinsic existence. So with regard to true cessation, it is there is a saying that it arises in dependence on cause, but it is not produced by cause as such.
So we are reading from page 414, Shamar Lamrim, the chapter on special insight. So till page 414, the outline that we have completed is the object, the negation of the object that is too broad or that is too wide. So when the object of negation is presented by Lama Tsongkhapa in the chapter on special insight, and also as the Shama Rinpoche presents the object of negation in this in his Shama Lamrim, the Bodh Master actually start with emphasizing on the importance of first recognizing what is the object of negations. And the special quote that usually comes here is by Shantideva, from the guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life, that until you do not touch the object of negation, it is impossible to gain a clear image of the emptiness, which is the elimination or the mere elimination of the object of negation. So in order to clearly understood or understand the object of negation, there are two misinterpretations of the object of negation. The first one is many of the earlier masters have an understanding about the object of negation that is too broad, where when we speak about the absence of inherent existence, they feel that all the phenomena will have their own inherent existence, which in turn says that there will not be even the conventional phenomena in terms of the day we speak in our daily life, the things that we do, and so we may end up losing all the basic things that we do. So that is the negation of the object of negation, which is too broad. So that part is already completed. And now from the next outline is elimination of the object of negation that is too narrow. So here there's a special reference to where the many masters referred to as the three features or the three qualities of nature or reality, that is the inherent existence and uncreated and non-contingent. And these three on one side and the opposite of these three, which are the dependent or origination and created. And the contingent. So these the three qualities, the two sets of the three qualities, cannot be established on one single phenomena. So when they speak about these three, the three features of the internal existence, then even the debate here that comes from. The debate here that especially comes from Nagarjuna's refuting the argument text, and also from fundamental of the wisdom and so on, is that the emptiness or the mere absence of the intrinsic nature, which is the emptiness itself, actually fits into the criteria of the first one. So the emptiness is generally uncreated, non-contingent, and also a kind of a reality, nature, reality of all the phenomena. So therefore, if you hold that the object of negation as similar to as the other opponent's presentation, then we may also end up accepting that emptiness itself has to also fall into that line. Then we may have to, the emptiness itself have to be also refuted by the reasonings of the ultimate investigation. So at the end of the day, so the conclusion of the argument is that their assertion of the nature of the object of negation as three qualities, that is reality and uncreated and non-contingent, is a kind of really too narrow, that if you hold that position, then even the emptiness will fall into that net. Then the argument further reads that when we speak about the reality, the emptiness is actually the reality or the nature of all the phenomena. For example, we have a special reference here by Nagarjuna from his text refuting of the arguments that the heat or the burning is the nature of fire. Sorry. So similarly, the absence of the inherent existence, absence of the inherent existence, is the nature of all the phenomena. So therefore, the emptiness actually fits into the first criteria. And the second one, which is referred to as the created, is actually referred to the creation. The term created or the uncreated here actually refers to, actually do not have anything to do with the causal creation. if we speak about any, if you speak about the phenomena that are actually caused by causal condition, then only those phenomena which comes under the circle of impermanence arrive into this criteria. But however, the term uncreated or the created here actually it covers all the phenomena as. It has been stated in the 20,000 verses sutra requested by the Maitreya that where the Buddha expressed very clearly that all the phenomena are temporary and temporary in the sense that they are created. So when the Buddha referred to all the phenomena as not having a very long-term reality or being referred to them as giving a reference to those things as temporary, so Buddha meant that actually those things are come under the category of what is called the creation. So the second quality actually also come a second quality of the uncreated. So the emptiness actually also falls into that criteria. The sutra actually reads that even though all the phenomena are said to be created, but Buddha has given a special reference to the emptiness is not being emptiness is being uncreated. And the metaphor taken here is that the nature of the fire, which is burning, is not a created nature of the fire. It is uncreated that comes along with the fire. Whereas if we hot water, if you boil the water, and the heat of the hot water is actually a created. Created nature of that hot water. So the heat of the hot water and the heat of the fire is different in the sense that the former is created while the latter is uncreated quality of that object. So the mere absence of the intrinsic existence of all the phenomena are not created by any causal conditions, so therefore it's the nature and uncreated. So the emptiness rightly falls into the second criteria, that is uncreated. And we also have to draw a distinction here. For example, the first moment of seed and the first moment of a plant, for example, and the second and the third moment. So actually, these three moments depend on causal conditions. But the emptiness or the absence of mere intrinsic nature of these three moments do not arise from causal conditions. But we have to say that they arise from dependence on other conditions. So the difference here is arising from causal condition and arising merely about depending on other factors. So we have to draw a distinction between these two explanations. And also, if since the emptiness is uncreated, and from the two phenomena of impermanence and permanent, the emptiness for being a permanent phenomena, it cannot have its own causal conditions, and also we cannot refer to the emptiness as being disintegration, which is the quality of impermanence phenomena. But then when the first moment of a plant transform into the second moment of a plant, we have to say that the first moment actually disintegrates and then the second moment of the plant come into beings. If that is the case, then the emptiness of the first moment of the plant also, when it changes, it transforms into the second moment, the plant's emptiness, then we have to also accept that the emptiness of the first moment of the plant also disintegrates. between the grids, when it changes to the second moment, then, however, emptiness being a permanent phenomena, how can there be the disintegration possible? So here we see that the disintegration of the plant from moment, first moment to second moment is due to the causal condition, whereas the emptiness, which is the quality of the first moment plant, and its disintegration does not happen by causal condition, rather by dependent condition. So this is the main distinction here. So, and when we refer to the conditions here and also arising, the term especially when we refer to as dependent arising, the term arising, we have to draw a distinction between the phenomena, one kind of set of phenomena, which is called the compounded phenomena. Compounded here has a connotation with respect to causal conditions, compounded due to many causal factors. And uncompounded in the sense that they are not compounded by causal conditions such as the space, emptiness, the selflessness, and so on. And the third quality of non-contingent or non-dependent, so actually we have this terminology used in different ways in the different texts, and also there are different arguments based on that. Generally, in the Abhidhamma Kosha, and Solon's comments here that when we speak, interpret the term tong or the empty or being something, so Solon says that according to the perfection of Wisdom Sutra, of course, we have a different understanding of it. However, when it comes to the Kalachakra Tantra and other Vajrayana teachings, it has a different connotation. And in Abhidhamma Kosha, the non-contingent or contingent, which has the meaning of dependent arising, actually refers to the dependent arising with pertaining to the cause and conditions. And Shama Rinpoche says that this is, and His Holiness says, this is my medicine drink, and how do you think about the taste? So this presentation that is coming from the Abhidhamma Kosha is actually according to the what we call the dependent arising pertaining to cause and effect. So this do not apply to all the phenomena. Then from the precious garland of Nagarjuna, then the non-contingent or the condition is expressed in two different ways. The first is rightly quoting the dependent arising sutra that since there is this phenomenon, so that happens. And also for the metaphor is also taken that since there is, in terms of the length, since there is the long object, then depending upon the length of the long, the short comes into being and so on. Which is again a contingent presentation with respect to interdependence, that a long and short or the tall and a short has to be high and up and all high and down, and all this expression has to do with interdependence or dependent upon each other. Then there is also another reference that due to the arising of this condition, these causes, then this result happens. For example, since there is the lamp, but a lamp, so the light comes. So the light is expressed here as the result, and the butter lamp, the burning of the butter lamp as the cause. So Nagarjuna has given these two different presentations with respect to the contingent condition of the phenomena in his precious garland. So if that is the case, then of course the emptiness or the mere absence of the intrinsic nature, of course it also depends on its basis of designation. So since emptiness also has its own basis of designation, and the emptiness is merely a designated title or a name on the object of the basis of designation, then the emptiness also had to be contingent. Then how come that your argument says that emptiness is a non-contingent? So Shama Rinpoche explains here that, or the Lama Tsongkhapa himself explains that here, when we refer to the emptiness as non-contingent, we meant the following. For example, when we refer to a long rope, or a long long rope, so the long rope do not have its own unique identity. So to establish the identity of a long rope, we need to always depend on a shorter rope for comparisons. So with the comparison of a short rope, then only we will be able to come into a conclusion that the other rope is a long one. However, as the emptiness or the mere inherent existence as the nature of, for example, the fire, then the nature of the emptiness as the nature of the fire do not have to depend on any comparison with respect to any other object. So the emptiness has been inherently, or in other words, from the beginningless time, the nature of the fire and all the other phenomena. So therefore, this is what we meant by saying that emptiness is the non-contingent. Sorry. Next is the presentation of the two truths with respect to the mind and its object. We have a reference. We have a reference here from the sutra that as long as the one is not free of the dualism appearances, so such a kind of understanding of the emptiness has to be considered as not complete understanding of the truth of ultimate. So when the masters come to interpret the citations, so the first one comes from the concise Lamrim by Lama Tsongkhapa. And Lama Tsongkhapa explains it in the following way. For the ultimate truth, the two categories of the first being the mind and the object of that mind. And here, actually, the mind also refers to the meditative absorption, the state of understanding the emptiness directly. And in the eye of the mind that understands the emptiness directly, it's only the ultimate truth that exists in the eyes of that mind. However, all the other conventional phenomena, which are by nature referred to as the appearances, referred to as afflicted by the dualism appearances, do not exist in the mind of the meditative absorption. So therefore, the emptiness itself is referred to as the real ultimate truth. But then when it comes to the mind that understands emptiness, there are two kind. The first is the inferential cognition that understood the emptiness through reasoning. And when that kind of inferential cognition gets familiar further, and after through a long process of meditative practice, and when those kind of inferential cognition turns or changes into the direct perception, the direct valid cognitions, so that is another set of the mind understanding the emptiness. So the later one actually arises through the inferential cognition. However, in case of the inferential cognition that understand the emptiness, even though that mind understands the emptiness and is able to eliminate the inherent existence from its purview, but it is not able to eliminate the dualism appearances. So the mind, the inferential valid cognition that understood the emptiness, even though it understood the emptiness very clearly, but we say not directly, or in the absence of the general meaning generality. So the meaning generality or the dualism appearances actually blocked the inferential valid cognition from seeing the emptiness very clearly. So therefore, those mind and the perception of the emptiness is actually referred to as the ultimate truth, which is similar to the understanding of the meditative absorption. So here we come to the conclusion of the two ways of referring to the ultimate truth, emptiness, from the perspective of the mind that understood it. And the emptiness itself, from its objective side, is similar whether any mind looks at, any mind understood it or not. So the emptiness itself, emptiness from its own objective side, is free of all the conceptual elaborations and the dual appearances. But due to the cognition that understood or that looks at the emptiness, be it the direct valid cognition or the inferential mind, so depending upon the cognitions that understood the emptiness, the different expression or the understanding, and also the obscuration of the meaning of generality, and the dualism appearances arises. So the categorization of the ultimate truth is actually not based not from the objective side of emptiness, but rather from the mental side, the cognition that understood the emptiness. Sorry. Next is Shama Rinpoche explains about the potential of the mind that understood the emptiness and how and which way they understood the emptiness. And we have a special reference here to the mind. We have a special reference here to the potential or the guidelines or the rule of all the mind that understood the emptiness and the conventional factors. So until one becomes enlightened, any kind of mind, whether it's inferential cognition or the direct valid perceptions, they're able to cognize only one set of the truth. So if the mind actually cognizes the emptiness, which is the ultimate truth, so there is no way possible that that mind can cognize or apprehend conventional truth. So the two truths actually never can never be understood by one single mind directly. So Shama Rinpoche has a quotation here first, and the quotation runs in the following way. The emptiness which is the free of all the conceptual elaborations can be actually expressed by the object, by a nature, can be referred to as a quality of the object of the basis of the designation. So emptiness cannot be expressed or understood without the object of the basis. And emptiness as a quality, and we also need an object that is the basis of the emptiness or the designation. So even though emptiness always, by objective side, by itself, resides in a way that it relies upon its basis of designation. However, when it comes to the mind that understood the object, so does the mind also understood in the same way? So that is the quotation. And Shama Rinpoche's commentaries comes in the following way. So Rinpoche further says that, so we cannot take the meaning of the quotation as being that even from the perspective of the inferential cognition, that when the mind cognizes the emptiness, it is to also cognize the basis of designation, a conventional truth. The inferential mind that cognizes the emptiness is merely understood a phenomena which is a merely absence of inherent existence. So therefore, the object that understood by the mind that understands the emptiness is merely what we refer to as non-implicative negative phenomena. So when we categorize all the phenomena into negative and positive phenomena, and also the negative phenomena are said to be comprising of two, the first one non-implicative negative phenomena and implicative negative phenomena. So implicative negative phenomena are those kind of negative phenomena which need to be understood by eliminating the object of negation, but with that we are also able to understand by the language and the mind, we are able to understand another positive phenomena. So the inferential meditative cognition that understood the emptiness understand only the non-implicative negative, which is the emptiness itself. So any kind of mind that understands the non-implicative negative phenomena can never perceive or apprehend any other phenomena such as positive phenomena or implicative phenomena. Then the next commentary by Shama Rinpoche comes starting with a debate that if that is the case, then what about the inferential meditative concentrations? So inferential meditative concentration is actually comes at the second level of the path, which is the preliminary path, the path before understanding the emptiness directly. So if that is the inferential cognition, and you explained before that when that mind cognizes the emptiness, it is blocked by the obscuration called the general meaning and the appearances of dualism. If that is the case, then whether the inferential cognition apprehends or understand the general meaning, meaning generality that actually obscures it. Because according to the presentation of the mind and the mental factors, it is said that all the conceptual thoughts, when they apprehend any kind of object, so the meaning generality comes into contact, comes between and blocked the conceptual thought from seeing the reality of that object. So if that is the case, then the first thing that such conceptual thought comes into contact is the meaning generality. And so the argument here is that whether the meditative state of inferential cognition that cognizes the emptiness, whether it cognizes the meaning generality or not. And Rinpoche, so His Holiness comments with respect to the distinction between the I and the object of I or the my. And when we develop the grasping of the I as intrinsic existence and also my or the objects that are the possessions of the I as intrinsic existence, there is a big distinction between these two, also in terms of the order of arising and development and so on. And the debate further continues by quotation by Shama Rinpoche that he quotes a text from Lama Tsongkhapa, one of the Lama Tsongkhapa's texts, and that which reads that any kind of the mind which has dual appearances need to say that they should be able to cognize also the meaning generality or one's appearances. So as far as the conceptual thoughts are concerned, the appearances of the mind, the appearances of the object to that conceptual thought and the meaning generality are actually the same object. So therefore, the meaning generality of the emptiness is also the object of perception by the conceptual thought or the inferential cognition that understood the emptiness. So the next outline comes here on page number 424. Sorry. About the appearances of the true existent and also the dualism appearances to all the mind. And Shama Rinpoche says here that in terms of the sentient beings who are not enlightened, all the kind of dualism appearances and also the appearances of true existence are actually originated by the power of the afflicted imprints of ignorance. So if that is the case, then all the conceptual thoughts need to have the appearances of true existence. So if that is the case, then what about the argument here is with respect to the appearances of the emptiness, which is the absence of true existence, and the appearances of the true existence. These are two distinct and contradictory phenomena. So the conceptual thought the inferential cognition that cognizes the emptiness is by nature a conceptual thought. So therefore, when it apprehends the emptiness, it understood or knows the emptiness. So the emptiness, which is the free or the mere elimination of true existence, also appeared to that conceptual thought. At the same time, it being a conceptual thought, and since by itself being a conceptual thought, it is also under the influence of the afflicted mental imprints of true existence. So therefore, it also needs to have an appearance of the true existence. So the true appearance of true existence and the appearance of absence of true existence, even though they're two distinct and contradictory phenomena, but there can be one single mind to which both of them appears simultaneously. But the reason and the way which appear to these minds are different. The first is that the appearance, the one is actually by understanding or knowing the object, and second is by itself being a conceptual thought, as it is being inflicted by the imprints of true existence, the mind grasping true existence. Next is with respect to the meditative absorption. So the direct valid perceptions of the meditative absorption state, it is said that when the mind is in the meditative absorption, only that mind is a very evident mind, and all the other minds which are not apprehending the emptiness are all in idle or inevident or latent form. And the yogi is said to be in a meditative state. So when that mind arises and become evident, so the argument here is, how does the practitioner understood the conventional phenomena at that time? Because there is no other mind that arises the conventional phenomena other than the ultimate truth, which is the emptiness. And we have also went with the argument with respect to the nature of understanding of the ultimate reality before. And the first rule was that a meditative absorption, when they understood the emptiness, they only understood the emptiness as mere negation of the true existence, which is a phenomena called the non-implicative phenomena. So any mind that cognizes a non-implicative negative phenomena, there is no possibility that they will cognize any other phenomena such as positive or implicative phenomena. So the conventional phenomena such as the pot and so on, being a conventional phenomena, there is no way possibility that it will be cognized by the meditative absorption. Then the argument, that was the argument, and the answer to the argument was that they understood the conventional phenomena by not understanding the conventional phenomena in the eye of the meditative absorption. So this is a technical phrase here, which is further interpreted and explained further in different texts. And with this completes the elimination of the object of negation that is too narrow, as we started with the first, the reality and uncreated and non-contingent, as that is being presented by the opponents or some earlier scholars. So till here completes the first two outlines, the first one being the elimination of the object of negation that is too broad, or too wide, and the elimination of the object of negation that is too narrow. So next is one's own system's presentation of the or the assertion of object of negation. And Shama Rinpoche starts with quoting some lines from his own monastery's text, where the few phrases such as the four major reasonings that normally referred to in all the texts. So there is actually a different reference here than the normal. So His Holiness was commenting that if a scholar speaks, then everything looks right. Sorry. The first start with the term, the Tibetan term Rigpa, or the reason, and also the Sanskrit term Yogir, or Vidya. So this has a different connotation in Tibet translation. There's also one Rig without the third particle Sa, which is a different meaning in Tibetan. The without the third particle in Tibetan actually means the mind or to understand something. So Rinpoche's conclusion here is that when we refer to the first set of reasoning, it is actually the first one. And these four sets of reasonings are what we call the reasoning investigating the ultimate nature of the thing, and the reason investigating the conventional nature of the phenomena. So all the reasons, actually, if we combine or categorize, so they can be categorized in either of the two said before. And Sasang Penchen, one of the scholars in one of his texts, which is the Compendium of Knowledge commentary, said that as far as the object of investigation is concerned, it can be further categorized as the evident phenomena and the obscure phenomena. And for the first, the obscure evident phenomena, it can be also further categorized as the causal, the cause, the result, and the nature. And all the resultant factors actually depend on their causes to establish their nature, which is by itself reasoning, is referred to as contingent reasoning. For example, the sprout or the plant depends on the seed to grow, and also the mental consciousness also depends on three conditions, the three causal conditions. And the causal conditions, or the cause, even though they comes first and the result later, but the cause also depends on their respective resultant factors in order to, in some correspondent way, which is referred to as the reasoning of action. For example, the reasoning of action here can be understood in the following metaphor, such as the seed grows the plant, and also the eye faculty can be the basis for the development of the eye consciousness, and so on. And also the external forms can be the focal condition of the eye consciousness, and so on. These are the metaphors used here. And next is the natural reason. So the natural reason reason of nature can be understood in the following examples. The first is about the burning nature of the fire, which has been there from the beginningless time, and there is not a time that the fire exists and the nature of the burning intercedes or doesn't, or the nature of the burning comes after the fire and so on. So which further says that the burning nature of the fire is the what we call the reason of nature. And the liquid or the solvent nature of water, and also the impermanence nature of all the compounded factors, and the selflessness nature of all the phenomena. So they are what we call the universal qualification of all the phenomena. And it is popularly known in this way. So these are as far as what we refer to as the evident phenomena. But then when it comes to the obscure phenomena, can be also categorized by the cause, result, and state, and its identification. So when it comes to the obscure phenomena, then we need to rely upon another set of reasoning to establish its reality. So even though we need to rely on a reasoning or a logic to understand that nature, but the outcome or the finding of that reasoning has to be corresponding to the findings by a direct valid perception. For example, when we use the reasoning such as the pot as being impermanent phenomena because it is a product. So due to the reason of being a product, we are able to establish the pot as an impermanent phenomenon. So even to understand the pot as impermanent phenomena directly through a mental consciousness, or to understand the pot as an impermanent phenomena depending upon a reason such as being a product, actually the process is different in understanding those two things, but the finding or the outcome is the pot as impermanent phenomena, which is same. So we will stop here for lunch.